Okay, welcome everyone to the LTD ATU Pension Trust Committee. It's November 8th, 2022 at 11 a.m. We're going to start the meeting off with a roll call of trustees. So when I call your name, just tell them to the mic that you're here. Starting off, myself, present, Mr. Gino Grimaldi.
Here.
Mr. Mark Johnson.
Here.
Mr. John Gangle.
Here.
Miss Christina Shue.
Here.
And Mr. Frederick Casey.
I'm here.
All right. We're all here. That's great. Just want to say thank you, everybody, for coming here. You know, I always like to reiterate that this is the important business for our retirees and our future retirees. The work we put into these committees and the decisions that we make are incredibly impactful in how people plan their lives. So this benefit is something we hold near and dear, and we want to continue to do good work on behalf of it. I will seek if there's any audience participation. Okay. So we will skip that section. The first item of business will be approval of the meeting minutes. They were sent out, and I think there was one revision that kind of came across, but if you had a chance to review the minutes, I'll entertain a motion to approve them.
So moved.
Moved by Mark Johnson. Anybody want to provide a second?
Second.
Seconded by John Gangle. Any discussion on those? All right. Seeing none, we'll just do a simple yay or nay. So all those in favor? Yay.
Yay.
All those not? Seeing none, passed unanimously. We will move forward to the report of the investment consultant. Everybody's very eager to hear what you have to say, Ian. Make sure you turn your mic on for the audience.
Perfect. Is this on, Bill? All right. Is this something that can be pulled up, or I'm not sure if everybody has it in front of them, or I'll start out talking about capital markets while we get the report up. So obviously the numbers we're going to look at today are as of Q3. Markets have been, pretty dire to say the least. I think the more, it's really just been a continuation. It's almost kind of verbatim of what we discussed in Q2, but of some fairly familiar themes in the capital markets. The Fed is, on the aggressive with monetary policy in terms of trying to tackle inflation, trying to get it back to some kind of, they say 2% level, but that seems, tough to achieve at this point. We keep getting, and maybe if you would move a couple pages ahead, one more. Perfect. Thank you. And so they've been on the aggressive approach in terms of monetary increases, 75 basis points at a time, fastest monetary policy tightening in 40 some years. They're forecasting now that, the terminal rate, or what they estimate to get inflation back to start coming down to more stated or normal levels, is probably in that 5 to 5.5 range. As of the more recent one that happened post these numbers, but in October, we're up to the 3.75 to 3 to 4% range right now on the federal funds rate. And so that is wreaking havoc, if you will, on markets in both fixed income and equity markets, which are, our traditional building blocks of portfolios. And so what we've been left with are equity returns that are down, somewhere in the ballpark of 20 some percent. I think as of Q3, you can see here, S&P 500 was down about 24%. As of today, it's down about 19% or 18.5. So we've had a little bit of a rally in October, probably not too dissimilar to the rally we kind of got in July. We'll see if this is a little bit of a head fake, but essentially markets are trying to hinge onto anything that Powell says with respect to the future pace of tightening. Are we going to continue to see 75 basis point increases? Are we going to get some slowdown to 50 basis point increases? You know, markets are really hinging on that right now. But, you know, on the flip side of that, they've got to tackle inflation. That's their key objective right now. And they want to be able to do that without pushing us into any kind of a deep recession. Jury's out if they're really going to be able to achieve that objective. They're really behind the eight ball right now. They haven't left themselves a lot of room here or a lot of tools to be able to do this. So we'll see if they can achieve so-called soft landing. History tells us it's not likely. We're probably going to see some kind of a recession. How deep or how severe that is probably left up a lot to do with how aggressively they need to continue tightening. So we'll see how that plays out, but you know, an interesting dynamic right now is what markets are hinging on with respect to how the Fed is going to, you know, change their path of monetary tightening going forward. In traditional kind of a normal operating market, good economic news is generally viewed as a positive thing for equity markets. You know, if we get, you know, unemployment coming down, job growth being created, you know, that's generally a positive thing. Equity markets tend to like that kind of, those kind of news. It means the future prospects generally are good for the economy. Right now, it's like it's this odd dynamic where the markets, every time we get news that's on the positive, on the upside, or a positive surprise is what they term it, it's viewed as a negative with the markets, because now they're saying, oh no, the Fed's got more room to tighten, or more argument to continue the tightening faster than they would like to see. And so it's kind of this opposite dynamic. Now, at some point, this will flip back, because, and it probably won't be until inflation starts trending down, and we're likely already into a recession, because then future cash flows for companies are going to be severely depressed or severely challenged going forward, have a significant headwind when we start seeing economic news start trending in the opposite way. And so what we've been left with this year is really the, you know, the negative 20 some percent of equity returns that have kind of retreated so far can almost be entirely attributable to the increase in yields and the discounting of future cash flows. The interesting thing is future cash flow projections still look pretty healthy. And so that's a somewhat disturbing kind of trend, if you will, because if we do start to get a recession coming into play, we could see, you know, in even more kind of a downturn in equity markets, even as, you know, the Fed probably starts to let off the gas a little bit in terms of the pace of monetary policy. So that's what's been happening on the equity side. Now, the really kind of interesting dynamic or unfortunate dynamic of 2022 that's kind of played out is that generally, and if you maybe would go to this next slide, please, you know, this is something that kind of wanted to show here that shows past kind of market, you know, performance for stocks and bonds that most people are familiar with. We've got tech bubble, GFC, taper tantrum, COVID-19. And what you see there is on the far left is the S&P 500 return, peak to trough, so high to low. And then you see next to that, the Bloomberg US Ag Bond Index, just a representative index for fixed income, if you will. And generally those move in opposite directions, or at least, you know, to some degree with some kind of a diversifying effect. The difficult part about where we're stuck in right now, which is that far right chart on the top, 2022, is that fixed income has been selling off or kind of been marked down, if you will, at the same pace as equity markets have been. And so really there's been no place to hide in terms of a diversified portfolio, in terms of saying, you know, where can we get away or what can we diversify our equity risk with? Traditionally, fixed income plays that role. 90% of markets over the past 100 to 200 years, the times when it doesn't work is when inflation is running as hot as it is now, similar to, you know, 70s and early 80s, Volcker era. And you can see there on the bottom, that's the rolling 3-year correlations of those two indices. And you can see that that's peaked up, you know, or jetted up pretty aggressively there And that's kind of just laying the foundation in terms of saying there's really nowhere to hide within this market unless you're willing to do some pretty drastic moves, which are certainly not advisable. But, you know, really the only places that you can hide in this market is if, one, you go 100% to cash, which you're still losing money on a real basis, or two, it's not necessarily a place to hide, but if you have a significant allocation to, say, like private investments, like private equity or real estate, private credit, which on paper just haven't been marked yet. So some plans that have large allocations of privates on paper probably look better than a more liquid portfolio. But at some point, those marks are going to start coming in, probably on the downside, and they're going to get marked. They're just on a leg. And so some peer rankings in years like this tend to be kind of skewed because those plans with higher private allocations just haven't been marked yet. Thankfully, in October so far, October into the early parts of November, we've seen kind of generally more positive markets. I think that markets are starting to see that there's a possibility that the Fed might slow down the pace of monetary tightening. But the Fed has, every single time they've come out with minutes from their meetings, they've essentially hinted to the fact that, hey, we think we can, you know, slow down the pace of monetary tightening, but it's highly dependent on data. I mean, that's what they're living on, the highly dependent on what's coming out. So, you know, every time we get a CPI report, every time we get a jobs report, every time we get, you know, big headline economic reports, that's what markets are hinging on. We've got a couple of those coming up. And obviously, then you throw in the kind of the election day and that kind of frantic activity that can happen with markets discounting where policy might fall on the long end of things, that affects markets as well. So unfortunately, we probably don't have some really exciting, performance to look at today. I would say that, you know, generally it's not too dissimilar to a lot of other clients that I've seen, if that's any kind of a reprieve for you all, but it's certainly been a difficult year and one that, you know, unless you have a portfolio that is extremely conservative and or one that has a significant allocations to privates, that's really the only way you're not experiencing the kind of returns that we're looking at in the top right hand corner, which is generally general exposure to equity and fixed income markets. Any questions on, happy to answer anything on the capital market spectrum before we jump into actual performance numbers.
No surprises there.
No, unfortunately not. Do you mind moving ahead to, well, it's page 13, please, on the bottom. Perfect, thank you. So we can see here how the kind of the years played out on the very bottom, that schedule of investable assets, you know, certainly not great numbers to look at. You can see there the gain loss. So down about 9 million or so through the end of September. I would imagine that with market returns so far this year, that we're probably closer to that 8 number, down about 8 million, which is, you know, translated at least as of September to a negative 21% return. You can see there that, you know, with everything, a lot of times in really big market turmoil, there's rebalancing opportunities because generally something's selling off way more aggressively than other asset classes. If you remember in particular back to the COVID-19, remember that first quarter that we had when equity markets just took a nasty hit and they went outside of policy ranges, those top ranges that you see on the top right box, they exceeded our policy limits. And so we were able to take some rebalancing activity and kind of rebalance back into equities that were hit extremely hard. You know, we did that in hindsight. It could not have been a more perfect time. And then we got the really good upswing from the equity markets post COVID-19 initial drawdowns. The interesting thing with this market is fixed income equity markets have been selling off generally at a pretty similar, a pretty similar pace. And so if you look at that chart right underneath there with the red bars, that shows us how far off our asset allocation is from our quote unquote target allocation that's in the investment policy statement. And we're not that far off, really. You know, we're you could trim on the edges here, but overall, there's not a significant place to kind of generally get back to target without, basically hedging around the edges. So that's been a difficult thing for investors to kind of maneuver this year as well. If unless you are, which is something that we're not, certainly wouldn't advise clients, but unless you are adamant about taking a stance that is drastically different than your target, there's not a lot of places to kind of get that rebalancing activity in or buy low, buy low, sell high type of activity. So that's something just an interesting dynamic of this market downturn that is very different than most, is how close most clients are still to their target allocations, because we haven't had markets that are dislocating much worse than other ones this year.
I had a question about that particular chart. You're looking at our allocation between domestic and international equities. They're pretty similar. And we've always had, the idea that international would at some point outperform domestic. And it's been lagging since I've been involved in the trust.
Yeah.
And obviously it's dragging us down more than domestic is. Is that long-term, you guys still betting on international markets? Because everything I see in the news is that the recessions happening in Europe are likely going to be worse than what's going to happen here.
Yeah.
So we still have this lag.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good question. And, we're coming up with our update to capital market assumptions here in early next year. Well, I think that's probably a place that we should really evaluate that. You know, it's a difficult question to answer broadly, just I think US versus international, because international markets have gotten so segmented. Future PEs look much better still in international markets than domestic markets. But what really drove domestic markets, over the past 10 years is like six names, six companies. I mean, realistically, those are the ones that really drove, and we all know them. They're the FANG stocks. They change names the acronym changes every year, I swear. Those are actually the ones that are down almost the most this year, some of those big tech names. And so it's an interesting dynamic to look at, because on one respect, the PEs of some of those really high growth names that have driven domestic equity markets for the past 10 years now look arguably much cheaper. On the flip side of that argument is a lot of those tech names are becoming much more mature companies that are having a difficult time transitioning to the post kind of run up in their subscription users. And, a lot of their key metrics are plateauing. Like you think about like the Facebooks of the world, the Netflixes of the world, like those Amazons even, a lot of those companies are trying to transition into being a more mature company and not just a high tech growth name anymore. They can't just bank on the fact that they're going to get 2 million new subscribers every single month, like they were doing for 10 years. And so it's an interesting thing to think about, that they still represent a massive weighting in the indexes that represent the US, but they are not the same companies that drove equity markets for the past 10 years. So I think you have to be more nuanced in terms of how you're allocating within domestic equity and international equity going forward. And I think that's something that we'll probably want to take a pretty good look at when we do asset allocation here at the next meeting, when we come up with our next capital market assumptions. But PEs still broadly look better in international equity. But I'm with you. It's been a slog of trying to figure out when that's going to materialize into better future returns.
Okay. Well, thanks, Ian. I look forward to that discussion.
Yep. It's a good question. And it's not one that's, you know, I don't think a lot of clients are asking, because, you know, if in hindsight, if you had been basically not in international equity for 10 years, you'd have done pretty well. Going forward, is that the same story? Generally, markets tell us that as soon as we overreact to any previous 10-year period, that's exactly the wrong inflection point. It's a tough argument to make. Hopefully, we'll try to quantify that to some degree at that asset allocation discussion. On page 16, I think, you know, here you can see generally, I would say that there's, you know, versus our, if we could go ahead three pages, please. One more, thank you. So on the top, we see the total fund performance. The line below that's our target allocation index, so kind of our passive benchmark. Below that is all pension plans, less than 100 million median, and then the ranking below that. So I probably have a few comments to say here about just that top section. One, you know, not outperforming year to date the target allocation index by a great amount, but keeping pace with it. And I think that there's a lot of clients that can say that that's probably not been the case this year. So that's a positive thing, I think, to take away from this, is that, you know, versus the target allocation index, the underlying managers are actually doing fairly well, not outperforming to a great degree as we've seen in some years, but generally keeping pace with kind of a passive benchmark. On the ranking side of things, you know, you can see their year to date, we're about in the 74th percentile, one being the best, 100 being the worst. So certainly not great rankings on paper. Again, I would caveat some of these rankings with the fact that there is a significant amount of your peers that have probably pretty big allocations to private equity and real estate that drastically change the spread of those numbers. So if we think where the median's at negative 18, I think the bigger thing that's a takeaway is how wide those bands are for any given time period. And this year-to-date band, we're seeing really wide, year-to-date time period, we're seeing really wide bands on those peer rankings. One, because if you've got a more liquid portfolio like we have here, we're a more mature plan, we can't allocate 20, 30% of the portfolio to private equity where we're not going to get those cash flows back for 15 years. The life of the plan just doesn't allow for that kind of illiquidity in the portfolio. We're kind of forced to be in a more liquid portfolio. I would say down 20 is pretty normal from what I've seen from a lot of different pension plans. Some of the peer plans that are more immature and have more cash flows coming into the plan going forward and are allowed some more flexibility with illiquidity, that have large allocations, private equity and real estate, you know, those numbers are coming in maybe more at like the negative 10 range for the year to date period. Difficulty to forecast though is when those marks come in, because they are lagged, where are those marks going to come in? Some of those private equity marks, especially in like high growth areas, buyouts areas, are looking pretty bad right now, you know, first marks. So while marks in their portfolio thus so far haven't been fully checked, if you will, when those marks come in, they'll probably get some kind of a whiplash effect in terms of rankings. If we do get some kind of market upturn, as we've had in previous years, the past few years, that's when your rankings and this portfolio look a lot better than some of those peers with large private allocations. So I always say to take those peer rankings kind of with a grain of salt, because the peer rankings don't have any idea of what kind of plan you are. What's your funded status? What's your maturity? What's your level of illiquidity? They have no knowledge of that. It just is a knowledge of these are all the plans that fall within the peer group. And here's the range of returns for the year. But I would say if you look farther out, so you look the past 5, 7, 10 years, we've had a really good 10-year run, you know, like even including the numbers that we've got so far this year. So I don't want us to lose hindsight of how good the portfolio's performed over the past 3, 5, 7, 10 years. We've been at about median, but we've done that with some really good manager outperformance at the target allocation index level, some really good alpha, if you will. And that's something that I think is a very big positive, that the 10-year number is still at 588, even though we've got a negative 20 attached onto the front end of that. If we look at, you know, underlying composite performance, I'd say, you know, generally equity markets in this portfolio have slightly underperformed. So some of the equity combined equity managers haven't quite kept up with the benchmarks. On the next page, the kind of the opposite effect, we've had a fixed income portfolio that has done better than the benchmark. Those have largely offset each other. And that's why we're kind of right at in line with our benchmark, is that generally that's been the trend so far this year. That's been one that's, I think, pretty consistent with a lot of plans that we've seen or a lot of clients. You know, if you've got a lot of allocations to some of those big tech names, like you do if you hold passive equities, that's generally been kind of a negative for you this year. On the flip side, on fixed income, if you're holding maturities that are much shorter than the maturity schedule or the duration of the benchmark, and that's just a fancy way for saying, of all the bonds you hold in your portfolio, from 3-month bonds out to 30-month bonds, if you kind of accumulate those all up, what's the average duration or the years that you're exposed on the yield curve? Generally, clients that have been short on the shorter end have done better because they've got less interest rate sensitivity. So when yields have gone up, their portfolio doesn't get negatively as affected as much. That's generally been the case with our fixed income portfolio here. We've had a shorter maturity schedule and we haven't been exposed to interest rate increases as much, and we've outperformed the benchmark. You know, if yields take a drastically different turn and all of a sudden in a year from now, it's hard to imagine a scenario like this, which is why most fixed income managers have been positioning the portfolio on the shorter end, but yields come down really aggressively, then holding some of that longer dated paper would be very beneficial to the portfolio. It's hard to see that happening right now. So I think, you know, structuring it on the shorter end makes a lot more sense right now. You know, even if you go back, we don't have to go back to the chart, but if you go back to where the yield curve sits as of today, you know, this is most people probably can't even fathom a time when the 1-year treasury is actually the highest yielding place on the yield curve. So if you hold 1-year paper right now, you're almost getting 4.8% on your yield. It's drastically higher than the 10 or the 30 year right now. So the front end is much higher than the back end. We all know that the inverted yield curve is a pretty good signal for future recessions. That's kind of where we are right now. The difference is past recessions is, you know, we're not talking about 2, 2.5 versus 1.5 anymore. Like we're talking about 1-year yields getting close to 5. That's something that, you know, you haven't seen really since the 80s. So it's an interesting time for fixed income. Going forward, what I would expect, and this is probably maybe a lead into capital market assumptions for our next meeting, is that fixed income, the one good thing about yields going this high, this aggressively, or this fast, is that fixed income now looks much more attractive than equity markets do, or versus equities. For a long time, you know, it was hard to justify large allocations to your portfolio in fixed income when you were basically signing up to get 1.5% for the next 10, 15 years. That's where yields sat. You know, you buy a 10-year treasury yield at 1.5. If you don't sell it, you're getting 1.5 for 10 years. Now you can buy a 1-year piece of paper at, you know, close to 4.8 right now. And in a year, you're going to get 4.8. Now, on a real basis, that's still a loss right now. So that's not something that most investors are taking very seriously, because, you know, you can't put the whole portfolio in something that's going to earn you 4.8. You're essentially locking in an actuarial loss. But what higher yields do mean going forward is that they be fixed income as an asset class looks much more attractive vis-a-vis equities than it has for the past 10 years. So I would assume when we do this capital markets assumptions exercise in February, we're going to be able to take advantage of that, the new dislocation of kind of where yields and equities sit, and be able to push a little bit more toward fixed income and still achieve some of that return potential going forward, instead of just taking on equity risk to try to get to our return objective. I can go through managers if you'd like, or I can stop there. If there's any specific questions.
Only if you think there's something of note in the managers. Otherwise, I don't think anybody else needs to hear about them.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You generally, you know, the story. I wouldn't say any managers have any issues from a team perspective that I need to report. Hopefully we get a good end to this year. But I would probably caution to get too optimistic about things until we start seeing some of those inflation numbers coming back down. The longer we go, the more months pass without, you know, inflation readings, especially core inflation, not the CPI print you see in the news, but like the real underlying core fundamentals, until we see some reprieve there, we're unfortunately probably in for a pretty tough coming months, because the Fed's got no choice but to keep their foot on the pedal here until we've got this thing coming in. But that concludes my report. I will let you know if there's anything to report inter meetings, if for some reason that does change or we breach targets or there is some rebalancing opportunity. I will say, maybe I forgot to mention this at the front end, but we did have the slight that cash that came in from the checking portfolio that we got invested over a 2-week span to bring those slightly back into target. But so that was where that net cash flow on the first page where you saw a positive number, that was that checking coming into the portfolio.
Well, thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions for Ian, then we'll move on to the report of the actuary. Scott, we'll hand it off to you.
Okay, thanks. We can get to first page of our presentation on screen. I know it's a little further down the packet. Okay, so our presentation will be pretty brief today. So obviously I'm here in person, Lacey's on the call, and so can jump in too if there's anything helpful for the discussion. You just have the RRB case. You don't have the board packet itself up. That's what it is.
On the board packet, it's page 68.
There we go. Thanks. So as I mentioned, it'll be a brief presentation. We're still kind of in the quiet period of the 2-year cycle. So we prepared the January 1, 2022 valuation and presented that obviously earlier this year. That set the rates for both current fiscal year and next fiscal year. So we're not kind of in the active valuation process right now for the ATU plan, but did want to give a little update on a couple things that are, take this opportunity, a couple things that are relevant for the trustees. So if we could go to the next page here. Thank you. So Ian just shared the, not so good news for 2022 year to date on the asset side. He made this point, but just to illustrate, you're not alone. All pension plans are kind of facing this right now. Milliman tracks a index of the 100 largest public pension plans. That was about 85% funded in aggregate at the start of the year. The way we measure that was down below 70% at the end of September. So this is, really pretty in line with what your plan has experienced. Those do tend to be a little larger plans, so they have more of the private equity and that kind of stuff under the hood. But other thing, obviously, in the environment that everyone's aware of is high recent inflation. So that has all the impacts Ian described in the market and in the Fed and all of that. In plans, depending on the nature of the plan, it can either come through if there are, you know, a public plan that has an automatic COLA that can come through in benefits and in costs right away. If it doesn't, like your plan does not have a COLA, then it really comes through on purchasing power of the retirees. So either way, it's an issue for plans and it's a hot topic of discussion for all plans right now. Also, Ian mentioned this sort of in looking forward to asset allocation discussion next year, but forward-looking capital markets are in flux with everything that's changing. And so that's going to potentially change some of the trade-offs between fixed income and equity in the future. It could change, given a portfolio, what you're expecting out of it in the next 10 or 20 years, where, you know, we've been on this cycle for the last 10 years. It's felt like where we've come in and said, your forward-looking expectations are going to be lower because interest rates have gone down and equity PE ratios have gone up and our capital markets and RBK's capital markets and everyone's has kind of been moving one direction. Some of that could change. And we've seen some of that change from investment advisors who kind of update mid-year that they've started to come up with higher interest rates and the different PE ratios and equity. So that's something, you know, we'll, between now and the next valuation, there'll be multiple times that gets discussed, but could affect kind of where the forward-looking expectation is next go around. And then the other thing, definitely the wonkiest, nerdiest actuarial point here that I'll have a couple slides on here just to keep you apprised of, but there have been some updates to actuarial standards. If you, read some articles for pension plans and trustees or go to continuing education in the last year or two, you may have heard some about this. And so just wanted to give a little bit of a context of what it is and what it means for your plan. Go to the next slide. So there exists out there an entity called the Actuarial Standards Board that sets standards for the work that we do and that we're bound by in our professional practice. And this covers all kinds of actuarial work, including, you know, setting car insurance rates and all that good stuff. But there's about 17 of these that affect what we do with pension plans. And one of the big ones has been revised recently, will start taking effect really for the next cycle evaluations we do for Lane Transit. So for the ATU plan, January 1, 2024 will fall under this. And it is called ASOP 4. So if you hear that mentioned, and it's kind of a big picture guidance on measuring obligations and doing all the fun stuff we get to do in actuarial evaluations. So the biggest thing that gets attention out of this new revision that they've made is on the next slide, slide 3, and is referred to as the low default risk obligation measure, or LDROM, for want of a more elegant term for it. But this is a new requirement that applies to all pension funding valuations, but it's really most interesting for a public plan because corporate and multi-employer Taft Hartley union plans already had required calculations that more or less met this requirement. And so what this says is that when we're doing a funding valuation, we're also going to calculate a number for you on a different basis, mainly a lower discount rate. So they call this low default risk because we're going to use a discount rate that's more commensurate with like a high quality corporate bond rate portfolio or a treasury component portfolio. And so there's still options and we'll work with trustees to kind of figure out what you want to do best for your plan. But what that means is you're going to have a number that shows lower discount rate, a higher liability. And you can draw some conclusions from that. It's not to say that this is a better number or the right number, and it's not the number you're funding at or that you really care about for contributions, but it tells you a couple things depending on how you look at it. And so that's kind of the point of it, really. Like you can look at it and say, well, you know, the fact that you are able to have a diversified portfolio and have a long enough investment horizon to expect to get a higher return than what you would get if you were, you know, just invested in treasuries or the highest quality corporate index, you know, that's a value that you're hoping to get by having that longer time horizon and that sort of being able to take that investment position. So that's one, you know, lesson you can draw from it. But it is liable to get attention. And we see this some certainly from people who are critics of public pension plans, that they may come back and say, hey, finally, there's this higher number that we've been thinking should be out there. And, you know, it's a point of information, but it's one that's going to be relevant for understanding what it is, what it isn't, and how to discuss it.
Are you guys going to be assigning colors?
We are not. Yeah, fortunately, the actuarial standard boards did not adopt the stoplight union plans are in the multi-employer Taft-Hartley space get to work with, but so we'll be out there.
Scott, is that something where all public pensions are going to have to start reporting both numbers? Or
they will, yeah. So it doesn't replace, I mean, it's not required for funding, and in fact, is really not a good idea for funding, and it doesn't meet the GASME requirements. So it won't be on either of those two big areas, but it will exist for pension plans. And there's not really a single place of where you need to report it, but when you do a funding valuation, this will start to be included for all public pension plans.
Oh, thank you.
So it'll show up as like an additional page within the valuation itself.
Yeah. And I mean, format wise and how we want to present it, there's no prescription on that. So it's going to be what, you know, I'm sure plans will take different approaches to it, but we already have a bunch of description about risk and measurements and how things can deviate from sort of the, you know, the median assumptions that we're using. So this kind of belongs in that in spirit. And so maybe in that discussion. Last slide for us is just other things that come out of this change to the requirement. There, a lot of these really don't apply to your plan. Some of the genesis of the revision to ASOP 4, which had been a decade-long process, included concerns over some, you know, kind of bad actors in the public pension world who may have continued to use unrealistic assumptions or had policies that really weren't meant to pay off the unfunded over time. So, I mean, you're probably aware of some of the state systems that did that for years or didn't make the contributions. So some of these disclosure requirements kind of put an onus on reporting if you're in that situation. So if there was significant bias in the assumptions, you would have to make that statement, or now we'll make a statement that says they're not, as long as the assumptions continue to be ones that we think kind of meet the purpose of the measurement. There will be commentary on the LD-ROM on that new requirement that we'll want to include in there. If you use output smoothing, there's something to address. You don't currently at the moment. The couple bullet points on amortization of the unfunded actuarial accrued liability is interesting and is important in that we already kind of implicitly in our valuation when we talk to you talk about the amortization period. They're set at 20-year increments for the most part when they've been set up, and then those get paid off over time. We'll have a little bit more discussion just to meet the, you know, nuts and bolts of what they're asking for here, but you already kind of do that. And most importantly, this statement about how long until contributions are going to cover the normal cost plus the interest, which is kind of like saying, when are you past the interest only point on your loan? If you think of an analogy for a home loan or something like that, your policy is you're already paying more than interest to begin with. So it'll just be, you know, making sure that's clear. But for systems that had kind of too long of amortization periods, this would call that out of saying, yeah, you're saying you're amortizing your unfunded, but you've got 30-year and level percentage of payroll, and you're not really paying down the unfunded for the first 15 or 20 years of this. So, you know, that's kind of what this is meant to call out. Again, doesn't really apply to your plan given the policies that you've adopted, but is one of the points of this. And then finally, if otherwise, for whatever reason, the system is not having a reasonable actuarially determined contribution calculated, whether because unreasonable assumptions or because, you know, they're not paying the actuarial rate, they're just paying a fixed rate, then it is required to actually calculate that to have something to compare against. Again, we have a policy in this plan that is calculating a reasonable contribution and you're paying it. So not really going to be a red flag or anything for this plan, but just for you to be aware of what's going on and, you know, how this plan and the policies you have in place are already meeting kind of the things they're trying to make sure are called out here. So any questions there, or Lacey on the phone, if there's anything I missed that you wanted to make sure we added.
I think you covered it all, Scott. Thank you.
Thanks.
had a quick question, Scott, if you don't mind, more just because I'm interested in it. So for like this applies to all public plans. Mm-hmm. So where would, if you're not like currently contributing the ADEC, like where would that show up where, like, let's say you're a large state plan where news sources can get a hold of that or something like that, where they're, because I could see that creating, especially ones that have like fixed contribution rates, something that are not meeting ADEC, where would you find that, that number going forward? Or where, better question, where would plans have to publish that difference between what they are contributing and ADEC?
Right now, there is actually in the GASB statements and the county statements, there are comparisons of the ADEC and the actual contributions. So that does exist, but that's, I think, kind of a loophole right now, is that's for plans that have an ADEC. And there's technically that ADEC could be calculated on unreasonable assumptions if the entity, if the trustees adopted unreasonable assumptions. Now they're, you know, if you were in that situation, that could be flattering your results there, right? If you're using a 9% investment return assumption, which no one would support, or something like that.
So who decides what's reasonable and not in terms of?
For this purpose, the actuary has to sign off on, if they can't say that it's reasonable under the actuarial standard, then we have to produce a number that does satisfy the actuarial standards for reasonability. So we're not, you know, we're not the arbiter of what is the exact investment return assumption. If we were to be in a plan where the investment advisor is saying it should be in this range and all the sources are saying this range and the sponsors do something way outside of it, then that's clearly not meeting the purpose of the standard.
Gotcha. Thank you.
So Scott, does it change any of the disclosures that we have then in our annual report, or is the same disclosures given that we're in compliance with everything that's here?
It really doesn't change the GASB disclosures. Okay. I mean, GASB always kind of reviews and updates their stuff. So they could eventually, once this is in effect and they know some of this information is there, I guess they could, if they wanted to add, rope any of it in. Mm-hmm. But this is really disclosures for the actuary in our report. Yes. So the stuff that we'll be giving you, you know, to the extent any of this needs to be added in your report, it will be. But like I said, most of the, several of these, and definitely the alarming ones, are not necessary, or their statements where we say there's no bias, or this already meets the interest only and normal cost. So
thank you.
So for now, you're saying it's just going to operate as food for thought in a report?
Yep.
Okay. Okay, any more questions for the actuaries? All right, seeing none, thank you. We'll move on to the report of the attorney. Jeff?
Still nothing to report.
I mean, that is good news, Jeff, thank you. But I'll ask anybody if they have a question for the attorney before we move past. Seeing none, okay. Well, then we'll move on to the report of the administrator.
Just sent the expenses and retirees since the last meeting. Everything is pretty typical, minus some invoices that were highly delayed in getting to me. But if you have any questions.
No,
I
think we kind of cleaned up those invoices, and hopefully you guys didn't find any more in a look back, but it'd be nice to be able to close the books on.
I started getting notices again. Wow, I mean, it's just like nothing, and now I'm getting notices.
Yeah, close the book on 2019 expenses. That would be good, you know. Yeah. We're almost 2023. Otherwise, besides that note, that's the only thing I was going to bring up in this section, which you had highlighted it, and I think we're moving forward.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and then the cash flow, I mean, everything's typical. We do show a little bit of a negative cash flow for the annual, just because I believe of that $700,000 transfer to investments, but I don't think that's not typically the way it's gonna be. It's a pretty positive cash flow plan.
Good to hear. Thank you, Sarah. Any questions for the administrator? All right, seeing none, we will move on to unfinished business. And we always have a standing item here, the COLA updates. And as our actuary did note, we don't have a fixed COLA or a formulaic COLA. It's just ad hoc here in this plan. We haven't done anything with it in, you know, since 2006. And just running quick numbers on that, you know, a dollar in 2006, you need a dollar 48 today. So it's gone up 48%. The cost of goods since then. We've talked about adding a COLA to this plan or doing something about COLA to this plan for the last 8 years. And when we first started talking about COLAs, it was a 20% purchasing reduction. Now we're over double that. So it's been frustrating to find the solution, but I still think it's incumbent on everyone to try to do best for our retirees and figure out a way to, you know, help them as they age. They did good service for us, and we want to find a way that they can continue to live a thriving life. Besides that, I don't have any other new business or unfinished business, but I'll open it up to the trustees here. Did want to welcome Gino to the team. He snuck in here. We didn't really make a big hey about it, but welcome Gino to the team. And I guess the last one would be our education. We didn't actually do our education this year. We missed the November annual meeting. I think we're looking at a potential training in June to kind of make up for that yearly loss of ongoing education. And those dates are the 19th through the 21st of June. And I think it's being held in San Diego. It's a pretty easy flight. Yeah, there's two different levels of training being offered. There's new trustees, and I think you highlighted the folks who are definitely in John for new trustees for sure. And then there's a second ongoing training for trustees that have been in the position for 3 to 5 years happening at the same time. So that might work out for all of us, really, to tick that off. And then maybe we can get back on the annual schedule of the usually late fall or mid-fall annual meeting for education. Besides that, let's find when we should have the next meeting. And usually we look at Ian.
Yeah, you're probably mid-February. We went on Tuesday. Due to the 14th would get me out of Valentine's.
This is recorded, man.
Yeah, probably. I mean, if we wanted to go into mid by the 14th or the 21st. But I didn't know. I was just saying the Tuesday since that's the day that we've been doing.
Honestly, that day is fine for me. Tuesday, the 14th of February.
Yeah.
That's a no-go. So what about the following week?
21st.
Yeah, so the 21st, maybe Gino is unavailable on the 14th. So the 21st, I would guess that is meeting week for the ATU. Although, you know, these meetings have been relatively short and straightforward. Brad, what do you think about doing a Tuesday mid-afternoon meeting during meeting week?
That should be fine, especially if we do a hybrid like this again.
Sure. We have the technology. We're doing it. Okay. The 21st, going once, twice. Okay. We're going to do it the 21st at 11 with the salary plan, I'm assuming, following right after. Okay. 2023. Okay. And then I think that's all we have today for the ATU LTD Pension Trust. Thank you, everybody, for your work on this pretty quick 55-minute meeting. We're getting good. I think we got this down. And I'll leave it to you all for the following meeting. So that's ATU signing off, and we'll leave it to you guys.
All right. So we'll start start the Salaried Employees Retirement Plan Pension Trust meeting. And just checking who's here. So Christina, I'm here. Mark?
I'm here.
Gino?
Still here.
Awesome. And then we have other guests. And let's see, the next thing is, I just want to welcome you, Gino, to our pension trust. Thank you for being here. And does anybody have anything they want to add to the agenda? Or have any announcements that they want to make? Any fine? All right. Do we have anybody who wishes to speak in the audience, Camille?
We do not.
Okay.
So I'd like to call it on the agenda for the salary. They still have Gangle and Casey and Bradley on the list of trustees for the salary plan. So we can fix that.
Good call out. Thank you, Mark. Do we need to add Jameson as well to the, or is he?
Well, he would replace me, so.
Okay. All right, so moving on, we have investment consultant. So do you, Ian, do you have anything to update for the salary plan?
Thank you very much. The only thing I might just say that's slightly different is, you know, if you recall, it was about last year when we kind of started the asset allocation of the ATU plan and this plan diverged a little bit. And so this plan's, you know, we're still down at about negative 20 mark, but it's marginally better than the ATU plan. We've got a little bit more of that fixed income buffer. So that would probably be my first point. My second point is that because the ATU plan had money that came into it last time, it's a little bit closer to target than this plan is. We're still well within, on page 13, it's all right if we don't pull it up, but I can just read the numbers to you. You know, international equity, we're down about 3% off target. Fixed income, we're about 2% over. That is well within policy ranges. So, and honestly, I have no crystal ball. So there's no way but my gut feeling is that being a bit overweight fixed income, it's probably not a terrible thing right now because we've gotten through such a big majority of the rate increases. So we are within policy ranges. So there's nothing in the policy that dictates that we need to do any kind of rebalancing. Mm-hmm. The only thing is I might just really quick ask is if there's any cash flow needs with respect to the checking account coming up. I know we're getting ahead of schedule on, and we don't even have to tackle this right now, but when we do discuss if there's any cash flow needs for this plan, then that might dictate where we pull or put money in. But assuming that there's no need for transfers in and out of the checking account to the investment portfolio, we're well within policy ranges, even though we're a little farther outside of the bands in the mm-hmm. ATU plan right now.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
I know it's out of order, but I your cash flow, I know we always have more outflow for the admin plan than,
yeah.
How are we doing on that?
We are in a negative, but I think at this point we added a hold. Dean, would you like to comment?
Sorry, had to find the unmute button.
Yes, the cash flow and the salary plan definitely is on the negative side over time. And the cash flow projection I did for this meeting was really just looking forward the next 6 months. So at some point we will have to transfer money from investments to checking, but currently in the next 6 months, I don't see that need arising.
Well, if that's the case, then I think we're probably fine as is, but I'll keep an eye on it. And if there's some reason we start getting kind of that into that territory where we start gaining or differentiating between fixed income and equity markets between now and the February meeting, and we get closer to breaching bands, I'll be sure to reach out to the trustees and we can formulate a plan at that time. But given the fact that we're not going to need to make any transfers for 6 months, we're well within policy ranges, I think we're fine right now.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Human.
All right, so the next is Scott. Do you have anything that you want to report specific to the salary plan?
Nope. I mean, big picture stuff from the 18 meeting applies here, but that's really it.
Okay, thank you. Jeff, do you have anything for the?
I do not.
Okay, excellent. Sarah?
Just, you know, the same typical expenses and retire. We had one retiree, I think, since the last meeting. That is in pay status as of now. I think two more kind of waiting or three more kind of waiting, but everything's pretty typical right now.
What is that one repayment of June invoices, please?
So if you remember back in June, we had switched administrators in our bill.com, and the administrator accidentally paid salary plan expenses out of the union plan.
Yes. Okay.
So we just sent that same stuff back in, and it's now null and void and done, repaid, and we're all good.
Awesome. Thank you. I just forgot.
No, that's okay.
It's like, oh, what's that? Okay. Awesome. Does anybody have any new or unfinished business that they want to go over?
So I don't know about Gino, if you've done any research, but the salary plan is a terminated plan, but you know, so, okay. And so there's no new members, it is what it is and whatever the investments are, and we'll pay out long term.
All right. Does anybody have any topics they want to make sure we have for the future agenda that's going to happen in February? All right, then our meeting in February will be on the 21st following the AGU meeting. And that concludes this meeting. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.